Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is October 26th. See how that's working. And we're going to finish up muscles and maybe move into, I think, blood today. So don't forget, on the 28th, which is this Thursday, is Exam 3. And the chapters in Exam 3 will be Autonomic Nervous System 9, Sensory Physiology 10, and Endocrinology 11. So muscle won't be on that particular test. Unless we want to have a show of hands, maybe we could figure out if we want to have that on the test or not. But that's okay, because on November 16th, which happens pretty fast, is exam number 4. Right? So that's in about 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks after. So that's when we're going to cover muscles. Right? So exam 3 is chapter 9, 10, and 11 only. Any questions on that? Good. All right, so next time, get here early with a pencil and a good eraser. And I think starting on that test, if there are smudges on your Scantron, okay, and if there's stray marks and things like that in the Scantron reader, then misgrade your Scantron. I won't regrade it for you. All right, so now you should know how to fill out Scantrons and bring a good eraser. You should have found a good eraser by Thursday. All right, so that's just standard test-taking skills. All right, so last time we were talking about a length-tension relationship in muscle, and this just basically says that there has to be proper overlap between the actin and myosin filaments for a muscle to develop tension. So if there is too much overlap, then the sarcomere can't shorten because the myosin is going to bump up against the Z-discs over here. So this sarcomere can't shorten anymore, therefore it can't produce any tension. All right, so that's what we see on this plot of relative tension versus resting length in a muscle. And then on the other hand, if the sarcomere is too stretched out, there is no overlap between actin and myosin, so no cross bridges can form between myosin and actin. And again, the sarcomere cannot develop any tension as a result. So there is an optimal region where there is a sufficient amount of overlap, but yet the sarcomere still can shorten. All right, so that's going to be really important. And athletes take advantage of this all the time because they're, stretching their muscles, they're increasing the elasticity of their muscles and adjusting this optimal relationship between myosin and actin just by doing stretching exercises. This is going to be a very important kind of relationship to appreciate when we get to the heart. Okay, so just remember, we're going to talk about it again. Okay, we're going to look at neural control of skeletal muscle. Well, what kind of nerves go to skeletal muscle? Yeah, somatic motor neurons, exactly right. So you could say somatic or motor neurons. And somatic is even better because these are not skeletal muscle is not an autonomic or visceral muscle. And the motor neurons, cell bodies, are in the ventral horn of the spinal cord. And then axons leave the ventral root. That's just something you learn from anatomy. So hopefully you have a picture in your mind of what that is. I don't really want to draw that on the board. All right. And those motor neurons are what we call lower motor neurons. That's the final common pathway that sends signals or action potentials to skeletal muscle. So there are other neurons that influence the activity of these lower motor neurons. And we might want to call those the upper motor neurons. Right, that activity is influenced by sensory feedback from muscles and tendons. So muscles and tendons have sensors to understand what the length of that muscle is and how much tension is being produced by a particular muscle. Right, and that's all fed into the cerebellum and then back down to the lower motor neuron. So those upper motor neurons can be facilitatory, which means they can help contraction or inhibit the activity of these upper motor neurons, which will then cause the muscle to contract more or relax, depending on particular circumstances. All right, so to control skeletal muscle movements, the nervous system must have continuous sensory feedback as to what the muscle is actually doing. All right, so if you think of any kind of control system, right, you just don't send excitatory signals to it, but you also need some kind of feedback signal, right, in order to find out if there is an error that's being produced. And then that feedback can be used in a negative way to get the proper control of that muscle. So there are two important kinds of sensors. involved with the muscle system. And the two sensors are the spindle apparatus and Golgi tendon organs. All right, the muscle spindles are found in the muscles, and the Golgi tendon organs are found primarily in the tendons, right? But what is a muscle to bone connection? Okay, that's a tendon. Yeah, it's a tendon, right? So this Golgi tendon organ is actually measuring what? Muscle activity, the amount of tension that's produced in that particular tendon because the muscle is contracting. Okay, so the spindle apparatus really measures the length or the amount of stretching that the muscle is undergoing, and the Golgi tendon organ is measuring the tension, the force that's being produced. And this is what the muscle spindle looks like. Now, it's not really drawn to scale. It's not something that you can see with your naked eye, because these are cells right here. And what do you need to see a cell? A microscope, right? So the spindle apparatus actually is a microscopic organelle inside muscles. It's located close to a tendon right here. And what did we say that the muscle spindle was going to measure for your nervous system? It was the length of the muscle, right? Okay, so let's look at this muscle spindle apparatus and see how it's going to tell your central nervous system what the length of this muscle is. All right, so here I see something that's kind of striated. What does that look like to you? Right here, where I have the cursor. That's just a skeletal muscle fiber, the usual skeletal muscle fiber, and you see all the different sarcomeres in there, right? And so these right here are the muscle fibers that actually contract and produce tension. These are the ones that are going to be doing work for us. And here is a nice neuromuscular junction. Here is a nice neuromuscular junction right here. And here is the somatic motor neuron that's coming from the spinal cord. And here you can see a motor unit. All right, so here we have one motor neuron, and how many fibers are being stimulated by this one motor neuron? Yeah, there's just two, right? So there's really fine control in this particular group right here. All right, so this one that goes to the muscles that produce tension and contraction, we call these the alpha motor neurons. But we also have other motor neurons, right, that go to the spindle apparatus. And here we have two different kinds of cells in the spindle apparatus. Actually, we're just going to call all these the same kind of cell. The ones that are outside of the spindle apparatus that produce tension for us, these are what we call the extrafusal fibers. But the ones that contract inside the spindle apparatus, we're going to call these the intrafusal fibers. And they are innervated with efferent signals so that they actually contract as well. But they don't when they shorten, they don't produce a lot of tension. Right? They just don't produce tension. They just contract and shorten, kind of go along with the ride that these extrafusal fibers are producing. Okay. But now you see some other things inside the spindle apparatus. There are sensory organs. And I'm not going to ask you much about these sensory organs right here unless you have questions at the end of the chapter or the online questions. But you see that there's a couple different kinds. There's some that kind of look like a spiral around this one fiber here that doesn't contract very much. This is what we call a nuclear bag fiber. All right, and then this one here is a chain fiber, a nuclear chain fiber that does contract a little bit. And the nuclear chain fibers has a little bit different kind of nerve ending. It has these flower spray endings right here. But nonetheless, okay, these endings right here can sense stretch of these particular muscles right here, the intrafusal fibers. All right, so what is actually going on right here? Okay, so the efferent signals going to the regular muscles that contract, the extrafusal fibers, will cause the muscle to contract, right? But the gamma motor neurons that cause the intrafusal fibers to contract then cause the spindle apparatus to contract to what the central nervous system thinks is the proper length of contraction. Now, they don't produce tension, all right, but they contract to what the central nervous system thinks is the proper length that this muscle should be at. So the extrafusal fibers and intrafusal fibers contract together, right, and the intrafusal fibers here always contract to the proper length, all right, But since spindle apparatus is embedded in the muscle, if the muscle is contracted to the wrong length, then it's going to pull right on the spindle apparatus right here. Right, so if both the extrafusal and interfusal contract to the same degree, right, then that's a proper condition, and there is no error signal being sent back via these sensory fibers to the central nervous system. Okay. But if these two muscles, if the intrafusal and extrafusal, don't contract to the same degree, then these nerve endings right here send action potentials to the central nervous system saying that the length is not the same. So that's another way of saying if the length is not the same, is that a proper condition or is that an error condition? That's an error. So the spindle apparatus is sending information back to the central nervous system about the error in contraction between the extrafusal fibers and the intrafusal fibers. And then the cerebellum sends signals back down to the extrafusal fibers to make sure that the spindle apparatus matches up perfectly with the contraction of the regular skeletal muscle. Right? And that's a nice negative feedback mechanism so that eventually, right, these muscles will be contracted to the same degree. So these are just measuring, the spindle apparatus is just measuring the amount of stretch, and if during coactivation of the extrafusal and interfusal fibers right here, if they both contract together, there is no error, and these intrafusal fibers here don't become stretched. It's only when there is an error that they become stretched, and then that causes, right, these alpha motor neurons to send excitatory impulses to the extrafusal fibers to get them to contract a little bit more until there is no error signal between the spindle apparatus and the extrafusal fibers. All right, so that's just what I want you to know, that the spindle apparatus can measure what? Error in contraction in a muscle due to stretch, and it's going to cause the extrafusal fibers to stretch a little bit more. All right, so the alpha motor neurons go to the extrafusal fibers, the gamma motor neurons cause coactivation of the intrafusal fibers inside the spindle apparatus, and we call that coactivation. And if there's an error signal, then the skeletal muscle, the extrafusal fibers, are then caused to contract a little bit more. So skeletal muscle protects itself not by relaxation, but by contracting. All right, so here is an important reflex, a monosynaptic reflex. So we're looking at, for instance, the rectus femoris right here with a spindle apparatus. And we see something that kind of looks like a red neuron right here. All right, so here are, does that look red? That's a nice red neuron coming from the spindle apparatus. So these are the afferent signals coming from the spindle apparatus, which is going to measure what? Stretch, an appropriate stretch of the muscle. And for instance, this happens when somebody is going to do a knee jerk reflex, like when we stretch the patellar ligament right here by tapping with the little rubber mallet that pulls on the patella, that pulls on the tendon right here, which then stretches this whole muscle, the rectus femoris, including the spindle apparatus. All right, so previously, the spindle apparatus has been told to contract to the proper length by the gamma motor neuron, but now something comes along and then stretches the spindle apparatus. All right, so that sends afferent signals to the spinal cord, right, via this nice unipolar neuron, right, in the dorsal root, through the dorsal horn right here. Here we have a nice motor neuron. All right, so this is what we call the lower motor neuron, and it only takes one to go from the ventral horn, right, out the ventral root all the way to the skeletal muscle. And this blue neuron right here is not going to go to the spindle apparatus. It's going to go to the extrafusal fibers of the rectus femoris in this particular case. All right, and this is not an inhibitory synapse. It's an excitatory synapse. So when the spindle gets stretched, that sends more action potentials up the sensory neuron, which releases more neurotransmitter, which causes what in this somatic alpha motor neuron right here? More action potentials, right? So you get more action potentials causing this rectus femoris right here to contract more. It's going to cause more of a contraction, right? Which is then going to protect the muscle. It's going to protect this joint from overstretching. So the stretch reflex is designed to protect muscles and joints from overstretching. All right, so the muscle is being overstretched. That's the stimulus. The response is contraction. And if you have the stimulus stretching and the response contracting, how do they relate to each other? Do they add or do they subtract from each other? So when a muscle contracts, it shortens. Let's start with the stimulus. The stimulus is, all right, we're stretching that muscle. What's happening to a muscle? It's getting longer when it's stretching, okay? But what's the response right here? Response is stimulating the muscle, which is causing the muscle to contract. So what's the relationship between the stimulus, which is stretching, and the response, which is shortening? Do they add or are they canceling out? Yeah, they're canceling out. So what kind of feedback mechanism is that? That's a nice negative feedback mechanism, which what provides for homeostasis, right? Okay, that nice negative feedback mechanism. So that's why we have these stretch receptors in muscles to maintain the proper length of this skeletal muscle right here to protect joints and even the skeletal muscle itself. All right, and this is what we call a monosynaptic reflex because there's only one synapse in the central nervous system right here, and that's the knee-jerk reflex. There are many other kinds of reflexes. Here is a Golgi tendon organ reflex. This is a bisynaptic reflex or a disynaptic reflex. Golgi tendon organs are in the tendons of muscles, right? And the frequency of action potentials increase as tension increases in a tendon, as you start to lift a heavier and heavier load. And the Golgi tendon organ reflex is a little bit different than the stretch reflex. The stretch reflex results in what? Contraction of a muscle, but the Golgi tendon organ reflex actually results in relaxation of a muscle. So let's look and see how that happens. So here we have a nice unipolar neuron going in, right, the dorsal root, and as tension develops in this muscle, it pulls on the tendon, so the frequency of action potentials increases on the sensory neuron. But now we have an interneuron. This is just a regular kind of multipolar neuron, right? And it gets excited, so there's an increase in action potentials reaching the axon terminus of this nice little yellow neuron right here. But this one is an inhibitory neuron, and it inhibits the activity of this lower motor neuron. Right? Maybe this lower motor neuron is receiving impulses from higher levels in the brain to contract, but this inhibitory interneuron now is going to counteract that stimulus, right? It's going to produce iPSPs. And so what's the job of this multipolar neuron right here? Neurons can decide whether or not to produce an action potential, right? At the axon hillock right here, depending on whether or not all the graded potentials reach threshold or not. So if this blue neuron is receiving a lot of excitatory postsynaptic potentials from higher neurons, right, but it also is receiving iPSPs from this inhibitory association neuron, they will cancel out, and then that will inhibit this muscle from contracting. All right, so the Golgi tendon organ reflex prevents excessive muscle contraction of this muscle. Now, how might that happen? Well, let's just say over the weekend you got a new refrigerator, right? And what do you got to do with that? It's out on the sidewalk. You want it where? Inside your house, right? So you call your friend over to help you move it in. You've got one end of the refrigerator. Your friend has got the other end of the refrigerator. And how heavy is the refrigerator? Really heavy. Can't lift it by yourself, right? That's why you call the friend over to help you. So you're going up the stairs, and then all of a sudden, your friend trips and lets go of the refrigerator. Now, who's holding up the whole refrigerator? You are. Can you possibly do that? Well, you can try, right? Maybe if you knew ahead of time, you can try, but what's going to happen to all of these muscles and tendons? Well, these muscles are going to rip, right? These tendons might pull off of the bone, all right? But fortunately, you have Golgi tendon organs, and these Golgi tendon organs all of a sudden say, well, instead of carrying 100 pounds, now you're carrying 200 pounds, which is way too much. right? It starts screaming action potentials to this inhibitory neuron right here, which then directly inhibits this alpha motor neuron. What are you going to do before you even know it? You're going to drop the refrigerator, right, and that's going to protect your musculoskeletal system. So it's a little bit different kind of reflex, all right? So it protects your musculoskeletal system from being overactivated, all right, under those circumstances. So that's a pretty good reflex to have as well. All right, so guess what? We're done with talking about skeletal muscle, but there are other kinds of muscles that you have in your body, namely cardiac and smooth. Now, these are kind of similar in what respect? Cardiac and smooth are kind of similar in what respect? They're controlled by the autonomic nervous system, so they're involuntary muscles. All right, well, let's talk about cardiac muscle first. One thing that cardiac muscle has in common with skeletal muscle, we see on this illustration right here, in that it is, just like skeletal muscle, it is striated. Okay, so I see striations, so cardiac muscle has sarcomeres, and these sarcomeres are arranged pretty much in the same kind of fashion. You have Z-discs, and what kind of filament is attached to the Z-disc? What are the two kinds of filaments you have? You have actin and myosin, so it's one of those two. It's actin, yeah, it's actin attached to the Z-disc. Well, you can't see that on this illustration here, but you should have a picture of a sarcomere in your mind. Okay, and myosin then in the center of the sarcomere. So it's the same kind of contractile apparatus. But cardiac muscle is not multinucleate. Skeletal muscle is multinucleate because it is the result of fusing hundreds or thousands of individual muscle cells together to form a long fiber. Right, so skeletal muscles are very long, but cardiac muscles are very short. They're just one single fiber. Like here is the length of one cardiac muscle. It has one nucleus. Now, skeletal muscle is linear, but what do you see with cardiac muscle? It has branches to it right here. That has some important implications that we're going to talk about in just a second. All right, so cardiac muscle is branched, but cardiac muscle also has voltage-gated channels in the membranes of these cells, so it can pass action potentials along the surface of the cell just like skeletal muscle and just like a neuron can, right? Because that's what you need for an action potential, a voltage-gated channel. Is that right? Is that kind of ringing a bell? Or as opposed to a ligand-gated channel, right? So there's voltage-gated channels here. Now, there's a special kind of communication between myocardial cells that skeletal muscle cells, and indeed most cells, do not have. It has an electrical synapse, all right? And that's produced by these gap junctions right here, which have those little sodium channels between neighboring cells. All right, at least where they butt up end to end over here. Not side to side, but from end to end. All right, also in these gap junctions there are special connections so that when tension is produced by this cardiac muscle cell on the right, it can pull on the one at the left without what? Separating or tearing right here. So there are special adhesion molecules that glue these cells together as well, besides for the sodium channels. All right, so sodium can go through these channels. So if sodium becomes high in the cell on the right, it can then move by diffusion through the gap junction to the cell on the left. And what happens to the cell on the left then? What do you call that when sodium increases inside the cell? That's depolarization. And is that excitatory or inhibitory? That's excitatory, right? Which then will trigger these voltage-gated channels to conduct an action potential. All right, so action potentials then can be transmitted from one cell to another, right to left, through these gap junctions. So if you stimulate one cell on the surface of the heart, what happens to all the cells on the surface of the heart? They depolarize, which is the first part of what? Excitation-contraction coupling. But because these cells are branched, where else does that electrical signal go? It doesn't stay in one level. It also drops down to the next level, drops down to the next level. So as you look at the whole thickness of the whole heart from a superficial region to a deep region depolarizes, as well from the more basal regions down to an apical region of the heart, that action potential travels through the whole myocardium. Thus, the whole heart does what? It contracts as a unit. You don't have one cell contracting and then another. In order for the heart to pump blood, it has to contract as a unit. Now, that would be really inappropriate for skeletal muscle to do that, right? Because right? You just go into complete tetanus every time you wanted to move one little muscle someplace in your body. You want to have graded contractions in skeletal muscles to lift different kinds of loads, and not to have every muscle in your body contract when you just want to contract like a stomach muscle, for instance, if you're going to be doing a stomach muscle exercise or something. Okay, so the structure of these cells determines how the heart functions a lot differently. It functions as a unit, right, because of these gap junctions right here. All right, should I go over any of that with anybody? Is that fast? But I think you could kind of follow that. Yeah. Oh yeah, it's a sodium channel. So gap junctions have a sodium channel, right? And sodium is a cation. And when you have a high sodium concentration on the cell on the right, it's going to diffuse to the cell on the left. And when it does, it depolarizes the cell on the left, which is an excitatory signal, right? It produces like an EPSP in this cell over here, which then can trigger voltage-gated channels, which then produces an action potential on the cell on the right. And voltage-gated channels are contained everywhere on the surface of that myocardial cell, so an action potential travels everywhere, including to what? Deeper layers of the heart, deeper and deeper layers of the heart. So we call that transmural excitation through the whole heart wall, from the superficial to the deepest layers of the heart contract. Yeah.
How do you think they bind the cells together other than the gap
junction? Oh, there are adhesion molecules. Right, so these cells, that's kind of, when I say glued together, that's kind of a loose terminology. It's not really glue, but there are proteins that go across the membrane right here that anchor the membranes together so that when these muscles contract, they pull on each other without pulling apart from each other. That's important, okay? Because these are not long fibers, they're short fibers. All right, so there are transverse tubules in cardiac muscle as well, and here we see a nice voltage-gated channel, and it opens up that allows sodium to come in. And that electrical impulse travels down the transverse tubule to bring that electrical excitation deep within the muscle fiber cell. And there are voltage-gated calcium channels in the cell membrane. So when an action potential goes down through this transverse tubule, calcium enters the cell. And then here's the sarcoplasmic reticulum in the myocardium, and the job of sarcoplasmic reticulum in muscle is to store calcium. And there are no ryanodine receptors right here, so whenever the transverse tubule depolarizes, it doesn't automatically open up calcium channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. These channels right here are just sensitive to calcium levels in the cytoplasm of a cardiac muscle cell, and when calcium increases, they automatically open up. So we call these calcium-induced calcium release channels. So when extracellular calcium enters through the transverse tubule, that's the signal that causes these calcium release channels to open up. All right, so that's a little bit different than what you saw in skeletal muscle. Most of the calcium that causes cross-bridge cycling, or the movement of tropomyosin away from the myosin binding sites on actin, in skeletal muscle comes from sarcoplasmic reticulum. But in cardiac muscle, it comes from the sarcoplasmic reticulum and calcium that is extracellular. So that's a little bit different. Right? It's kind of almost an even balance. Right? So nonetheless, calcium is important for cross-bridge cycling, but in cardiac muscle, that calcium comes from outside the cell as well as the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which is a little bit different than skeletal muscle. In skeletal muscle, most of it comes from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Okay, and then cardiac muscle relaxes, right, after that action potential goes away. This calcium ATP pump right here is always pumping calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and if there's no action potentials, more calcium gets put into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. These channels have closed, these calcium channels close, and then the calcium level goes to such a low level that you can't sustain cross-bridge cycling anymore because tropomyosin moves over the binding sites, right, the myosin binding sites on actin right here. Okay, so cardiac muscle still is dependent on calcium. Some of it comes from an extracellular source. Some of it comes from sarcoplasmic reticulum. And what would happen to cardiac contraction if we were to inhibit these calcium channels right here, or these calcium channels on the sarcoplasmic reticulum? If you were to take some kind of agent or drug, a pharmaceutical agent, that blocks these calcium channels right here, what would happen to cardiac muscle contraction? It would, right? It would diminish the effectiveness, right, of the contraction of these fibers, because you would be reducing the amount of calcium inside these muscle fibers. So that's a way to reduce the contractility of muscle contraction or cardiac muscle contraction, right? And that's used clinically quite a bit. We call those calcium channel blockers, all right, to reduce the activity of somebody's heart when it's contracting, for instance, maybe under certain circumstances of high blood pressure or other kinds of circumstances where we want to reduce contractility of the heart. That's a pretty good drug of choice. Okay, we'll talk about that more when we get into the heart chapter, which is coming up really soon. All right, so the mechanism for cardiac contraction is exactly the same for skeletal muscle, in that on this actin molecule, you have a big long tropomyosin, right, that covers up the binding sites. Calcium doesn't bind to tropomyosin, it binds to what? Troponin. And when calcium binds to troponin, it causes tropomyosin to get out of the way. And so you need to have high levels of calcium bound to troponin to get tropomyosin out of the way so that myosin can bind to it. And then you'll have sliding of the filaments over each other. So use the same sliding filament mechanism in cardiac muscle as you do for skeletal muscle. All right, smooth muscle, quite a bit different. It is similar to cardiac muscle in that it is involuntary, right? It still has actin and myosin filaments, but they're no longer arranged in a fashion that you're familiar with in terms of what we call a sarcomere. Okay, so here we have smooth muscles, and we look at the smooth muscle right here. If you didn't know that was muscle, maybe you couldn't even recognize it right now, but I'll tell you that that's a muscle fiber right there. And if I tell you that's a muscle fiber, you can tell me what kind it is, because why? It lacks striations, right? There are no sarcomeres in smooth muscle. So it has no sarcomeres. But some kinds of smooth muscle do have gap junctions, right? So some smooth muscle contracts in unison, just kind of like the heart does. It has many more actin molecules than myosin, which allows for greater stretching of the muscle and also shortening. The muscle can actually shorten to a greater degree. Now, in cardiac and skeletal muscle, the actin filaments are bound to what part of the sarcomere again? The Z-dis or Z-lines, right? But in smooth muscle, okay, they're anchored to structures on the cell membrane that we call dense bodies. They're not deep inside the smooth muscle cell, they're right on the cell membrane. All right, so actin are these blue filaments right here. You can see here's a dense body with blue filaments coming out of it. And here's another dense body with some actin filaments coming out of it. And then bridging these two dense bodies in the very center are myosin molecules. All right, and so there's no repeating pattern, all right, not like in skeletal or cardiac muscle. We also see that there's a denser arrangement of myosin head groups on a myosin on this thick filament right here. And some other things that are different, the ATPase in this head group is a lot slower. It takes a lot longer to hydrolyze an ATP, right, to recock this head group right here, which then says that if this ATPase is slower, contraction or the sliding of these filaments also takes longer in smooth muscle compared to skeletal or cardiac muscle. So smooth muscle doesn't contract with the same speed compared to cardiac or skeletal muscle. So it's slower to contract. Okay, so what I maybe want to do first is look at a slide. Let's look at a graphic and then go back and talk about these slides. I'll talk about these slides in a little bit. So here is an important exam figure. Okay, and let's just review some things that we're aware of already. Okay, and that is, what's the name of an enzyme that phosphorylates something? Something that phosphorylates, that is running around and then maybe is using up ATP to phosphorylate something, like a protein. That's called a kinase. Yeah, a kinase. Okay, and then we name that kinase by the substrate that it phosphorylates. Okay, what is the name of an enzyme that dephosphorylate something. That's a phosphatase. Yeah, that's a phosphatase. Okay. And when you phosphorylate something, what can happen to the activity of, let's just say it's an enzyme. If we phosphorylate an enzyme, what's going to happen to that enzyme? It can change the activity of it, right? It can activate it or it can inactivate it depending on the particular enzyme. And the same thing for dephosphorylating an enzyme. That can either activate it or inactivate it, but if it's that same enzyme, then the phosphatase is going to have what? The antagonistic action compared to the kinase. Right? So on one enzyme, a kinase and a phosphatase won't produce the same action, right? It will be antagonistic to each other, whatever that action is, right? Either inhibitory or excitatory. Okay, so here we have some things that are going to be called phosphatases and kinases. But the first thing that I see on this slide right here is a graph of membrane potential. Ooh, of what kind of cell? Ooh, what are we talking about right now? What kind of cell are we talking about? Smooth muscle. Yeah, smooth muscle cell. All right, membrane potential versus time. And we can see that in a smooth muscle cell, we don't see a rock solid baseline resting membrane potential, right? It kind of depolarizes a little bit, goes back down to resting membrane potential, depolarizes a little bit more, all right? But notice that these are subthreshold stimuli, and then it depolarizes to a greater extent right here, and then that produces action potential. So smooth muscle, kind of like the heart muscle, is autorhythmic. You don't necessarily need to have innervation to cause smooth muscle to contract, but innervation from the autonomic nervous system maybe can help adjust these graded potentials to happen at a greater frequency or at a greater amplitude. All right, but smooth muscle can be autorhythmic. All right, so you have depolarization, right? So these action potentials produce a high degree of depolarization, and then that opens voltage-gated channels in the plasma membrane. Now, where is calcium at a high concentration? All over your body. You would just say outside. This is true. Same thing for smooth muscle. And smooth muscle has very little endoplasmic reticulum. So there is very little calcium stored inside the cell in endoplasmic reticulum. But nonetheless, calcium entering the cell is an important signal or is an important part of the excitation-contraction pathway in smooth muscle. But where does that calcium come from in smooth muscle? It is extracellular, right? So for skeletal muscle, that's not so important. Cardiac muscle, it's a little important, but for smooth muscle, it's way important. That signal comes from outside the cell. So calcium enters the cell because these are plasma membrane voltage-gated channels that open up. And in smooth muscle, there is a regulatory molecule called calmodulin. And you remember that calcium and calmodulin have a high affinity for each other? They sure do. And what's a cousin molecule that you're already familiar with that's similar to calmodulin that likes to bind calcium that then changes metabolism inside the cell? Calcium can bind to, have you heard of troponin in skeletal muscle? Yeah, because troponin, right, calcium binds to troponin in skeletal and cardiac muscle. Troponin then moves tropomyosin out of the way, so it's kind of the same kind of scheme, but a little bit different. In smooth muscle, calcium binds to calmodulin, right, so calmodulin-calcium complex then can dephosphorylate an enzyme that we call myosin light chain kinase. All right, so it dephosphorylates myosin light chain kinase, and myosin light chain kinase, when it's phosphorylated, is really inactive. All right, so what's the job of myosin light chain kinase? Kinase, what does a kinase do? It's going to run around and phosphorylate things. Okay, and what's it going to phosphorylate? It's going to phosphorylate myosin, and in particular, one small chain on a myosin molecule. And what kind of molecule is myosin? It's a thick filament, right? It's a thick myofilament that's important for contraction, right, for sliding of myofilaments. So myosin light chain kinase then becomes active. It's going to phosphorylate myosin. And do you remember where that myosin was? Maybe we should go back a couple of slides. Right, here's the myosin. Here's myosin, right, in a smooth muscle cell. So myosin light chain kinase is going to run around phosphorylating a bunch of groups on this myosin molecule. Right, let's flip forward again. And when it does so, right, then it becomes active. So the myosin in smooth muscle has to be phosphorylated before cross bridges can form. So that activation is a little bit different. In skeletal and cardiac muscle, it's always activated. It's just waiting for tropomyosin to get out of the way. But in smooth muscle, as soon as myosin becomes phosphorylated, then it can start to contract. Okay. So what does, and smooth muscle starts to contract when what happens? When calmodulin binds calcium, and before that, calcium has to enter the cell, and before that, what has to happen? The membrane has to depolarize. So we just kind of went backwards. Okay. Now, this is a lot longer process, so that, again, kind of tells you that when a smooth muscle contracts, it takes longer than skeletal muscle because of this little bit more of a complicated mechanism. All right, so again, this just shows how phosphorylating an enzyme can either activate it or inactivate it, and in terms of myosin light chain kinase, it's what, the dephosphorylation that makes it the active form. But what about for myosin in smooth muscle? What's the active form? It is the phosphorylated form that is active, not the dephosphorylated form. All right, so you might say, well, gee whiz, what causes then smooth muscle to relax? Once this thing is, once myosin is phosphorylated, it's going to cause contraction. You got to have a way to relax smooth muscle. All right, and that's because there is an enzyme that is always present and active inside smooth muscle, and it is something that takes the phosphate off. What do we call an enzyme that takes phosphate off of something? A phosphatase, right? And the substrate is myosin. So what would you call that enzyme? Myosin phosphatase. That myosin phosphatase is always in an active form, all right? And so smooth muscle contracts depending on the balance between the activity of myosin light chain kinase versus the activity of myosin phosphatase. It's always in a balance. Right? It's only when you have action potentials, you have more activity from myosin light chain kinase than you do from myosin, which causes cross-bridge cycling. But when there are no action potentials, the activity of myosin light chain kinase goes away, and then the phosphatase takes over, and that causes dephosphorylation of the myosin, which then causes relaxation of the muscle. Okay, so you can see this is quite different compared to skeletal muscle or cardiac muscle. So what do these words say about that? So don't forget, this is the kind of sliding filament model that we're interested in, with these dense bodies, actin attached to the dense bodies and myosin in between them. So smooth muscle contraction is controlled by calcium, but it's different than in striated muscle, right? Striated muscle has sarcoplasmic reticulum, but smooth muscle really does not. And smooth muscle also does not have troponin, tropomyosin controlling cross-bridge cycling. Right? Calcium enters through voltage-gated channels in the cell membrane. So the calcium signal is extracellular. And then that calcium binds to calmodulin. Right? That calcium-calmodulin complex activates myosin light chain kinase, which then does what? What does myosin light chain kinase do? It's a kinase. It's got to phosphorylate something. And what it phosphorylates is myosin. And in so doing, that activates myosin. Right. So myosin light chain kinase activates myosin so it can be turned into an ATPase, which means cross bridges can cycle, which means then that what's going to happen to those dense bodies right here if these filaments start to slide together? Not together, they slide over each other. The dense bodies are going to be pulled together. But not just this one right here, not just these two dense bodies, but dense bodies everywhere on the cell, so that cell is just going to pucker up all together. And so from the distance from tip to tip of the cell is also going to get shorter. It's going to shrink. And I have a nice action model in my office that I forgot to bring down that kind of shows that. But I'll bring it before the test, and you can go, ooh, cool. Okay, so this cell shrinks because these dense bodies get pulled together. Okay. Now, don't forget, myosin ATPase is slow, so smooth muscle contraction is slower. For relaxation to occur, calcium concentration has to decrease because of the calcium pumps. It pumps it out of the cell. Then myosin is dephosphorylated by the myosin phosphatase. Then cross bridges could no longer form, so the smooth muscle then starts to relax. And it takes a while for that to happen. So contraction and relaxation in smooth muscle is slower compared to cardiac and skeletal muscle. And because of the different arrangement, smooth muscle can actually stay contracted for a longer period of time without producing a metabolic fatigue of the muscle, as in cardiac or skeletal muscle. We call that a latched state. And remember, okay, what causes relaxation? What causes the breaking of a cross bridge? It's when myosin binds an ATP, right? So that's not the same for smooth muscle. So actin and myosin can stay bound together, which then prolongs the contraction without using up ATP inside the cell, which is really good. Because, for instance, how long does the cervix have to contract under certain circumstances? 9 months, okay? That's a really long period of time, okay, to maintain pregnancy. And so that would be bad, for instance, if someone were to feel the same sensation when a skeletal muscle contracts and goes into tetanus. What does that feel like? Okay, yeah, it hurts like hell, right? So, because of this latch state right here, smooth muscle is not using up ATP, it's not producing lactic acid, it's not producing the same kind of painful stimulus, right? So somebody's not in that excruciating pain for 9 months, for instance, when the cervix is contracted maintaining pregnancy. So smooth muscle can maintain force while using very little energy as a result of that. All right, so not on the test on Thursday, but on the next test, this is an important exam figure, okay? Because all semester long, we've been talking about phosphatases and kinases and how they can adjust enzymatic activity, changing activity inside of a cell. Well, here's a really good example of how a phosphatase can cause relaxation of muscle and how a kinase can cause what contraction of a muscle, in particular smooth muscle. Okay, so that's it for muscle. There's one thing that I do have a couple questions in the either the end of the chapter or online for you, okay? And I didn't go over, I don't have any slides on this, so I want to write it on the board, so hopefully you can see the board. Maybe I'll turn on some of these other lights right here while I write on the board, okay? All right, so what's the energy molecule that's necessary for muscles to contract? ATP, exactly right. So ATP has got to be present so that an activated myosin can release from actin, and then ATP is hydrolyzed, and the myosin head then recocks, ready to go through the power stroke again. So ATP is necessary for muscle contraction. And under, when you use a skeletal muscle, sometimes we go through a little bit of energy, like when we're walking around, but every once in a while, maybe if you're exercising or doing some kind of sporting activity, the activity of a muscle can increase by 100 or 1,000 times, which then means it has to do what? Use more ATP by a factor of 100 or 1,000 times, which is a huge increase. So mitochondria have a hard time keeping up with producing that much ATP because, don't forget, also when a muscle is contracted, blood can't get into the muscle and no oxygen gets in, so mitochondria activity is reduced because it doesn't have oxygen. So there's another system that tries to protect the level of ATP inside certain organs, and the heart is one organ, skeletal muscles are another, and another organ that's very sensitive to ATP is your brain. All right, so there's a reservoir of high energy phosphates in these tissues, and it's called creatine kinase. All right. No, it's called phosphocreatine. Creatine kinase is not the reservoir. Creatine kinase is the ACE. ACE means it's an enzyme. Right, so you have creatine right here and ATP. I might have to change my marker. All right. Oh, that's a little bit better. Going to phosphocreatine, ran out of board, plus what else? We put a phosphate on creatine. Where did it come from? ATP. So we don't have any ATP left anymore. What do we have? We have ADP. All right, so then we have ADP right here. And the enzyme that allows for this reaction to take place, ooh, we almost buzzed the speakers right here, is called creatine kinase. All right, so what does a kinase do? It phosphorylates something. So it's taking creatine and phosphorylating it, for sure. All right. So this is actually kind of an interesting reaction because the delta G for this reaction is basically zero, which means what in terms of the activity? Does it like to go to the right or to the left? Since the delta G is zero, it likes to go either way, right? It all depends on what? Depends on the concentrations of these metabolites right here. We'll force the reaction in one way or the other. What do we call that? Law of mass action, or you could say Le Chatelier's principle. Okay, so when a muscle is not exercising, there's plenty of ATP around, so ATP concentration goes up. All right, when ATP concentration goes up, what happens to this reaction? Which way is it forced? It's forced to the right, so ATP concentration is brought down a little bit, but in the meantime, phosphocreatine concentration goes up. All right, so you have under resting conditions, you have a lot of phosphocreatine. All right. Now you start exercising, and you start to use ATP up. And when you use ATP up in muscle contraction, what else are you building up? You're building up ADP. Which way does an increase in ADP force the reaction? It forces it, yeah, to your left. It forces it, yeah, to the left. Okay. And when you're exercising, ATP goes down. Which way does that force the reaction? To the left. So as it goes down, it forces it in this direction right here. So under conditions of exercise, when ATP decreases or if ADP increases, like during exercise, this creatine kinase reaction then can use a store of phosphocreatine to build what molecule back up? ATP, which is what you need for action potentials, action potentials in the brain or muscle contraction. So the creatine kinase reaction is a way to maintain ATP concentration even though you have some transient circumstances where you use a lot of it up very rapidly, more so than what the mitochondria can produce for you. And then when the muscle goes back to normal and ATP concentration goes back up high again and ADP goes down, what happens? The reaction shifts back to the right and it stores that phosphate group in creatine or phosphocreatine, and as a matter of fact, this bond right here, the creatine phosphate bond, right, that should actually kind of be like a squiggle. That's a high energy bond. Just like what? The bond between the last phosphate in ATP and the second phosphate in ATP. So phosphocreatine can store energy inside the cell for those peak demand times when you're using a muscle without activity of the mitochondria. Yeah. The purpose of that is to, for instance, if you increase this concentration of creatine inside the cell, which way is it going to force the reaction? It's going to force it over here. So they're trying to build up the store of phosphocreatine so that when they get into a heavy regime of exercise, right, and their mitochondria can't produce a lot of ATP because it's not getting oxygen, what can that extra level of phosphocreatine do? When ATP starts to go away and ADP starts to increase, then that they think that extra store of phosphocreatine then can replace ATP really fast so that they can perform better. And I don't know if that's ever been shown biochemically to be true, but you have to be a little careful with this creatine molecule right here because it can plug up kidney tubules. I'm not familiar with that. Yeah, I'm more familiar with activity in the nephron. And that's one organ you never want to play around with, right? Like your heart, your brain, kidneys. Really important to keep functioning all the time. Okay, so that's the creatine kinase reaction. The job of creatine kinase reaction is to maintain what energy molecule? ATP primarily in muscle, brain, and heart. Well, cardiac muscle, skeletal muscle, and the heart. So there are a couple of questions in there. All right. So that's it for muscle, unless I think of something else. That's good. So let's move on to, oh, no, rats. I got a couple more slides. Oh, good. I'm glad. I knew there was something bothering me. Okay, smooth muscle. A couple more slides. We can finish this today. Okay, smooth muscle. All right, so all of these smooth muscles will contract, just like what we were talking about. Okay, but there can be different kinds. There can be single unit versus multi-unit smooth muscle. All right, single unit smooth muscle is spontaneously active. We can say that it is autorhythmic or myogenic, that it can generate its own signals for contractions. So some cells are what we call pacemakers. They then can control other smooth muscles in that same organ or within that one layer of an organ. So if one muscle can cause or can excite other neighboring muscles, what kind of synapses have to be between these muscles? There have to be gap junctions between them. So here's another place where we can have gap junctions. I think I just ran out of batteries. Wow, I sound really weird. Yeah, okay, the transmitter is out. So I got to reset my ear because it's really a lot different talking without an echo as opposed to with an echo. Okay, so single unit has gap junctions. So if one cell depolarizes, what happens to all the neighboring cells in that organ or layer in that organ? It contracts as well, right? So gap junctions spread that electrical activity between all the neighboring cells in that region. Multi-unit requires nerve stimulation by the autonomic nervous system. It's not myogenic, it's not autorhythmic, right? But the neurotransmitter released is not from a synaptic terminal or an axon terminal, it's caused by what? Varicosities. And I think I've showed you varicosities before when we looked at the autonomic nervous system. It's like a chain of pearls along an axon of an autonomic neuron, right? The post-synaptic autonomic neuron. And we call those synapses in passant or in passing. So here are the two kinds, right? Single unit versus multi-unit on the bottom. Here we have a nice autonomic neuron. So this would be what? The postsynaptic, not a postsynaptic, the postganglionic neuron, right? The postganglionic neuron. And it's going to release excitatory neurotransmitter on these cells right here. And since this is single unit, if one of these smooth muscle cells reaches threshold and depolarizes, what happens to all these cells? They all depolarize, right, because of these gap junctions right here. Okay, multi-unit smooth muscle, on the other hand, like what we have here in the iris, because we have to control constriction or dilation of the iris, right? It has both sympathetic and parasympathetic innervation, and these will release either excitatory or inhibitory neurotransmitters, which then will produce EPSPs or IPSPs on the smooth muscle. So the smooth muscle has to decide whether it's going to contract. And what's that based on? How much sympathetic activity or parasympathetic activity it's receiving. So that's a lot unlike a skeletal muscle, right? Skeletal muscle only gets excitatory signals, never can make up its mind, but smooth muscle can integrate information from these two divisions of the central nervous system and make up its mind what to do. Okay, and this is what we call multi-unit because there are no gap junctions, so this cell can contract independently of this one and independent from this one right here, right? And so these act as different units from each other, but single unit, they all contract in unison. All right, so that's the big difference between them. All right, so that's it for skeletal muscle system, or muscles in general. There's some nice comparisons there. Okay, so for blood, some of you maybe have a little bit of background with blood, depending on what kind of courses you've taken. We don't talk about blood very much in anatomy. You know kind of what it looks like, but we don't do a really nice analysis of blood. So in physiology, I like to review a little bit more. Okay, so we'll start maybe with some functions of blood. Some functions, of course, you know that it transports oxygen and nutrients. Like, give me an example of a nutrient. How about glucose? Yes, glucose sounds good. Enzymes, various kinds of enzymes and hormones to tissues. You could list a whole litany of hormones, but I won't ask. All right, some enzymes that control blood clotting, for instance. Okay, but not only does it transport oxygen, it transports carbon dioxide and other kinds of waste products from tissues. All right, and it also is important for heat transfer. It can take heat from one part of the body that's too hot and carry it to some parts of the body that are too cold, right? So heat transport is very important. Blood can carry a lot of heat, and blood's important for maintaining fluid balance, electrolyte balance, and one of the important electrolytes that maintains pH is? What's the electrolyte that's responsible for pH? What is pH a measure of? Hydrogen ion, right? It's just a cation, kind of like sodium, but it's very important because it changes enzymatic activity quite a bit. It's also protection of the body from disease-causing microorganisms, foreign substances, and even tumors. And we all have tumors. Some of them don't take over, and that's because our immune system is functioning properly. In other individuals, some tumors figure out a way to defeat that individual's immune system for whatever reason and start to take over, right? So that's an important point. And also, since blood, what kind of tissue is blood? It's a connective tissue, but it's a funny kind of connective tissue. Why is it funny? It's a fluid connective tissue. So if you put a hole in a blood vessel, it's just going to run out of your body, but of course you need to have it in your body, so there's got to be an important mechanism that prevents blood loss whenever a blood vessel is damaged. All right, so that's an important function of blood. Okay, so the circulatory system includes the cardiovascular system, but also the lymphatic system. I'll talk about the lymphatic system in a little bit, too. All right, so the heart pumps blood through the cardiovascular system. Blood vessels carry blood from the heart to cells to deliver oxygen and nutrients. All right, and then it returns to the heart. What kind of vessel does blood return to the heart in through? A vein, right? So that's really the definition of a vein and an artery. Not whether it's carrying oxygen or carbon dioxide. It's just the direction of blood flow. So arteries do what? Do they carry oxygen? Some, but do all? No, not all do. Okay, but what do all arteries do? Carry blood away from the heart, whether they're high in oxygen or not. All right, and veins do what? Carry blood toward the heart, whether it's oxygenated or deoxygenated. And we'll talk about, would you like maybe an example of an artery that is deoxygenated? That is deoxygenated would be the pulmonary artery, taking blood to the lungs. It's low in oxygen, because why is blood going to the lungs? To pick up oxygen, so there's no reason why blood that's high in oxygen needs to go to the lungs, right? So pulmonary artery is low in oxygen, and what kind of vein is high in oxygen? The pulmonary vein, because it's coming back from the lungs, right? Okay, so that's just a little trick you got to see. Lymphatic system picks up excess fluid filtered out by capillary beds, and then it returns it to the veins, and when it flows back to veins, it goes through lymph nodes, and those lymph nodes filter lymph to make sure there's no bacteria or other kinds of nasty particles in there. Okay, and so it functions as part of the immune system. All right, so let's think of blood for just a second. The composition of whole blood. So what the heck is whole blood? For instance, if you cut yourself and that stuff starts to leak out of you, that red stuff, we call that whole blood, right? It's got cells and it's got fluid. So those are the two main compartments in blood. There is a fluid part that we call plasma, and then there are things that are made up of cells, and we call that formed elements. So the two major classifications, or the two things that make up blood, are plasma and formed elements. Let's look at plasma first. Most of plasma is water, 92%. About 8% are proteins. And we've got three different classes of proteins. We've got albumins, globulins, and then clotting factors are necessary to prevent blood loss. Okay? Albumins are important for water balance. We'll talk about that in a little bit. All right. Globulins fight infections, but they also are used as detergents to carry hydrophobic compounds around. Like what kind of compounds are hydrophobic that are transported in your blood that we talked about? Like steroid hormones and thyroid hormones, right, are hydrophobic, They dissolve in blood because they can bind to globulins. Oh, did we talk about thyroglobulin? Oh, I think we did. Okay. That helps dissolve thyroid hormones in the follicular fluid inside a thyroid gland. All right. But there's also ions like, I don't know, what's your favorite ion? Sodium, because it's excitatory. I like that. Okay. Various kinds of nutrients, glucose, gases, oxygen, carbon dioxide, bunch of waste products like urea. All right. So in plasma, we do have clotting factors. All right. Sometimes we take these clotting factors out. All right. So if you take plasma and take the clotting factors out, plasma minus clotting factors, we call that serum. And sometimes we might even call that anti-serum, because if you have plasma, take clotting factors out, it might also still have globulins in there that can fight infections. And if it can fight infections, or maybe there are globulin that can fight a venom, right, then that would be called an anti-serum or an anti-venom. It's just serum that has special little proteins in there to fight that venom that you get a shot of after you get bit by a rattlesnake, right? But that serum shouldn't contain clotting factors, because if you get injected with it, not only does it fight the venom, it would cause a massive clot in your body. So we got to take those clotting factors out. So serum or anti-sera, right, is just plasma minus these clotting factors, and it might have special little antibodies in there to fight infection or, venoms, for instance. All right, formed elements. What did we say formed elements are? They're cells. Most of the cells are red blood cells, otherwise known as erythrocytes, or erythro really is another word for red, right? Then we have white blood cells, less than 1%. There's very few in there. And those are leukocytes. So leuko right there means white. What's the animal symbol for the United States? You know, a lot of countries have animal symbols I like to put on flags and stuff like that. It's what? The eagle. What kind of eagle? Bald eagle. They're not really bald, are they? No, they just have white feathers on their head. So you could probably guess what the scientific name of a bald eagle is. Leuco-something. Yeah, it's leucocephalus. Remember, cephalic means toward the head, leucocephalus. So leukocyte is a white blood cell. It's nucleated. Red blood cells are anucleated. All right. Platelets, 5% are platelets. These are cell fragments. They don't contain a nucleus either. And these are called thrombocytes because they help make thrombi, which then prevent blood loss under certain circumstances, which we're going to look at in this chapter. All right, so this is a pretty good overall introduction to blood, and we're going to start here a week from today. Talk about hematocrit. So after the test, you get a little bored over the weekend, go ahead and read up on blood a little bit. Try to figure out what hematocrit means.